The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Mark Golub, the president and CEO of Shalom TV, the largest Jewish television network in America. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. You know, the strangest thing has been happening to me since last Tuesday night. I've been simply devouring bread, pasta, and pastries like they're all being discontinued. I just can't get enough leavened carbohydrates. It's as though I were loading up to run an ultra marathon, when in fact my longest run any week these days is a very slow 7 miles. No, my compulsion to consume yeasty wheat products stems from another reason. It's the corollary to the bread deprivation experience of the previous week, plus the Passover process of not eating chametz for a long period. And now you cannot safely put me in a room with a loaf of bread, and certainly not with any donuts. Wait, hang on. Somebody just brought a sandwich into the room. Bread. Okay, so we completed the Festival of Pesach last week, and as usual at my own Temple Emmanuel, we finished with the delightful Moroccan Jewish end of Passover festival, the Mimuna. Even the name of Mimuna has obscure origins. Some people think it is named after Maimonides, the most famous Jew ever to live in Morocco. Others attribute the name to food origins or economic ones, but wherever it came from, it's a fun and delightful way to end Passover with songs, stories, and lots of celebration. This year we had a huge drumming circle and the craft creation of chamsas, traditional good luck decorations from the Sephardic world, as well as a terrific concert with lots of dancing by everyone. Moroccan treats and moufletas, special pancakes flavored with honey, chocolate, and jam, and belly dancers. It was absolutely great, and if you missed it this year, don't miss it next year. After all, Pesach only ends once a year, but it should be celebrated, and it does indeed end every single year. Thank God. So now that Passover is over and we've gone back to eating bread and bagels and cake and donuts and breakfast cereal and muffins and, well, you get the idea. Life is back to culinary normal, and a good thing it is. In fact, the absence of leavening from our lives and the eating of so much matzah-based foodstuffs for the week of Pesach might now seem like just a bad gastrointestinal dream, if not for one small fact. If you, like me, buy your matzah in quantity, it's a much better deal that way, after all, then you are now left with an unconscionable and, of course, nearly inedible quantity of matzah. What to do? Well, singer Michelle Citrin has some suggestions.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah big and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it as confetti for a happy new year.
Insulate.
Decorate.
9. Exfoliate.
10.
constipate? Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzah when you practice your karate. Build a matzah dog house for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzah board and wave it goodbye. Or you can make a pair of matzah wings and learn how to fly. Wear some matzah jewelry. Make a picture frame for me. Have a drink of matzah tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
Clever Ways to Use Matzah When You Don't Have to Eat It Anymore by singer Michelle Citron. I must tell you that now that Pesach is in our rearview mirror, I will not again eat matzah until the 15th of Nisan next year. That is, at next year's Seder. That's a pledge I can keep. Well, from the second night of Passover, for the next 7 weeks, we are entered into an interesting and somewhat poorly understood period called the Counting of the Omer in the Jewish calendar. It's a somewhat archaic practice in which we recall the ways our ancestors in biblical Israel brought a special grain offering every day between Passover and the coming holiday of Shavuot, one offering each day for 7 weeks. These offerings serve to mark the 50 days between the Festival of Freedom and the holiday of receiving the Torah at Sinai in covenant, and this period became a time of additional holiness to our ancestors, and it can for us. In the period of the Counting of the Omer, for example, now, Orthodox and Conservative Jews actually do not perform weddings, with the exception of a few special days, and each evening of the 7 weeks we add a small section to our liturgy, our prayers, in which we number the days we have traveled from Passover towards Shavuot. As the book of Proverbs instructs us, we number our days so that we might make each day count. In musical terms, this counting of the Omer lends itself to some wonderful interpretations. Here's a fine choir from the Budapest Rabbinical Seminary, and some of the blessing before chanting the counting of the Omer.
Yeah.
from the blessings for the counting of the Omer, the seven-week period between Passover and Shavuot, the holidays of freedom and covenant. If you, like me, are actually counting the days, today is the 12th day in the counting of the Omer. When we return on to Jewish this morning, we'll meet our guest Ishmael Chaldi, Israel's first Bedouin diplomat, a Muslim from a Bedouin village who now represents Israel throughout the world. A fascinating and brilliant young man. Meet him, find out what it's like going from growing up in a tent to serving in the foreign service of a modern Jewish nation. All when we come back on to Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, most of the time I'm talking about the great pizza we serve at Mama's, but not today. Nope. Today I want to tell you about our calzones. A calzone is kind of like a stuffed pizza. It's made of dough wrapped around whatever ingredients you want, like pepperoni, mushrooms, or even artichoke hearts. There's lots of cheese inside, and it's served with a cup of marinara sauce. Our calzones are huge. We had a guy order two of them over the phone, and when he picked them up, he couldn't believe it. There were only two people eating, and two large calzones feed 6 to 8 people easy. You know, it wouldn't hurt you to try a calzone next time you're in. Then, if they get real popular, we might have to change our name to Mama's Calzones. Mama's Pizza, 4500 East Speedway in the Midway Business Park, on the east side of 22nd and Colb, and back at the Fry Shopping Center, on the north side at the southwest corner of Oracle and McGee, and on newest at Broadway and Houghton. Now repeat after me, Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is an independent school for children from kindergarten through 8th grade. Has a long-standing track record of academic excellence and an unparalleled integrated general and Jewish studies curriculum, with a variety of music and fine arts classes combined with the award-winning sports programs, THA nourishes students in body, mind, and spirit. The atmosphere in the classroom encourages self-assured self-expression, critical thinking, and respect for diverse points of view. THA's low student-teacher ratio gives its highly qualified faculty the ability to provide instruction based on the most up-to-date proven research methods in science, technology, math, and literature. THA students understand the relevance of Jewish values in a modern world. THA sees learning as a way of life and builds a strong sense of community. THA Tucson Hebrew Academy is enrolling now. Give your child the gift of a THA education. For more information on how to enroll or to schedule a tour, call 529-3888. That's 529-3888 or visit thaaz.org.
We're delighted to welcome to Two Jewish this morning our guest, Ishmael Chaldi. He currently serves as the policy advisor to Israel's foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman. He became policy advisor after serving for 2 years as deputy consul general in San Francisco for Israel. He is Israel's first Bedouin diplomat. Born and raised in a Bedouin village in northern Israel, he lived in a Bedouin tent until he was 8 years old, served in the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, the Defense Ministry, the Israeli police, and then was chosen for the foreign ministry. During the disengagement from Gaza, Ishmael Chaldi served as Israel's official spokesperson to the Arab media. That must not have been a very easy job. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish Ishmael Chaldi. Boker Tov, good morning.
Boker Tov.
Tell me a little bit about that status. It's on all of your publicity, the first Bedouin diplomat for the state of Israel.
To be a first always a special thing. You know, making a breakthrough. Nobody did it before, and you have to learn everything by yourself. How come you are coming from different background, you are coming to a new world among Jews all the time, and you are... It's not easy. So challenging.
It's challenging. I wonder, you know, you came out of a Bedouin environment. Education hasn't always been the highest priority for Bedouin. Tell us a little bit about the status of Bedouin in Israel today.
You know, Bedouins are a shepherd society in our regions. And we are
Jews too, actually.
Wandering Jews, yeah, the Bedouins, exactly. And we are part of the Arab culture, part of the Arab population in Israel. We are Muslims. We are considered the more secular Muslims, because Bedouins used to move from place to another, and they didn't build mosques, so didn't practice, you know, religion, and also didn't build kindergartens, and didn't build
and
schools.
And madrasas and such.
No, I mean about education. So religion is education, and education were not part of our culture, tradition. So I have to, Bedouins are two parts in Israel. The Negev community and the northern community where I'm coming from. And we are Israeli citizens, we are a culture in transition, we are trying to move, you know, from being nomadic shepherd into more settled, organized community as part of Israel as a modern country.
Are the Bedouin in the north of Israel more settled than the Bedouin in the Negev?
Yeah, obviously, because the Galil was much more populated, even with Jewish pioneers, Halutzim, who came to establish the country in 1920s, 1930s, until 1948. And the Bedouin, that was the first years where the both communities connected, Jews and Bedouins. And 90% of our community in the north lives near a kibbutz or a Jewish town. And we learned quickly, you know, from them, to settle down. Started to work in the kibbutzim, change our lifestyle, while the Negev still, until today, have so many economic, social issues, problems to deal with.
There are, and we'll talk much more about Bedouin and about what it's like to be the first Bedouin diplomat, and being a representative of Israel to the Arab world, when we come back a little later this morning with Ishmael Khaldi on Too Jewish.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife Ann are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old. My wife is 86. And we like staying in Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo. They made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation invites you to experience Enduring Eyes, Remembering the Holocaust to Protect Our Future. Enduring Eyes is an exhibit of first-hand descriptions and photographs that explores the history of the Holocaust, the atrocities leading up to and during the Holocaust, and emphasizes the importance of protecting our civil rights, a priority the FBI upholds. Enduring Eyes, now showing and free to the public at the Jewish Community Center, 3800 East River Road.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from twojewishradio.com or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. Well, today on the Jewish calendar is known as Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, one of the more recent additions to our list of special days of observance. The Hebrew name for this day, Yom HaShoah, comes from the Bible, and it means a whirlwind of destruction. The English word Holocaust, which was from the Greek and was first used as early as 1833 to refer to destroying lots of people, was originally a translation of the Torah word for a burnt offering, an offering burnt up completely by fire. It's not till 1957 that it's applied in a general sense to the Nazi destruction of all the Jews of Europe. However it's phrased, This Shoah, or Holocaust Day, is an important day of remembrance. This Yom HaShoah marks the 50th anniversary of the famous Adolf Eichmann trial in Israel, and that has brought that remarkable event back into the realm of public consciousness. If you're not familiar with it, Eichmann, the architect of the terrible Final Solution that murdered 6 million Jews, was captured in Argentina by Mossad and Shin Bet Israeli Secret Service operatives. A brand new book by former Two Jewish guest, the fine American historian Deborah Lipstadt, explains all the details of that trial and the fascinating fact that the prosecution, led by Israeli Attorney General Gideon Hausner, chose to bring all kinds of important facts about the Holocaust into the trial that had, frankly, nothing to do with Eichmann. They did this consciously in order to bring to light many elements about the Shoah and the operations of the Nazis in ways that would make it indelibly clear what took place, how, and why in the greatest crime in history. This was supposed to convert the Eichmann trial into a powerful historical experience that would testify to the reality and fact of the Holocaust in a way that could never be denied. Although in many ways the trial was successful, Eichmann, of course, was convicted and eventually executed, the only legal execution ever done by the State of Israel, which does not have a death penalty, the trial did not succeed in preventing morally perverted deniers of the Holocaust from continuing to emerge, as it says in the Passover Haggadah, in every generation. Which is why it has become essential to hold Yom HaShoah commemorations annually. And it is why it's necessary for all of us to recall these immensely painful events, so that, in remembering, we can try to be sure they will never happen again. We welcome our maven on Israel, the head of the Israel Center, Guy Gelbart. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So Israel is well known for its technical expertise. No institutions more so, perhaps, than the Technion in Haifa, your hometown. They were here recently for competition. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yes, definitely. Just lately, a mission of 10 students from the Technion Aerospace Department came here to Tucson to a competition led by DBF. This competition was organized by an organization called the World Forum for Aerospace Leadership. It was an international contest of flying drones that were made by the students. This mission was led by Professor Benny Lankoff from the Technion, a very well-known Israeli professor for aerospace engineering.
You know, Israel has had to be good at aerospace engineering because, after all, so much of superiority, military superiority, is dependent on air superiority in the Middle East. They don't have anything like the budget of these other colleges, do they?
Not even close. But in many ways, that's what makes Israel so special, because, you know, it's a famous joke that NASA can make everything happen, but then comes an Israeli company and does the same in one-tenth of the price. So that's the thing with the Technion and with this mission. Actually, when they came over, they didn't have even the budget to bring their plane with them, so they mailed it through the mail to the Jewish Federation here in Tucson, and we needed to handle all the customs and everything to convince the customs that it's only toys for children, you know, a toy game.
So the drone that they sent over, which probably has serious implications, you know, I mean, it's designed, I'm sure, as an unmanned plane to do all kinds of stuff. So you convinced them that it was a hobby plane being mailed to the Jewish Federation so they could enter it in the contest when they got to Tucson.
Yes, actually, it looks like a hobby plane if you don't really know what it's able to do, yeah.
So can you tell me what it's able to do?
Well, this one was a civilian plane. It doesn't have any military aspect, but it was very unique with all its abilities to fly and have self-control on parts of the flight and aspect of that sort. And I think the most special thing is that it was designed from bottom to top by students, undergrad students.
Wow.
And they built it. They made it all themselves.
You know, when I was an undergrad, I was not busy designing unmanned drone planes with miraculous capabilities. You know, Israeli undergrads also, probably worth noting at the Technion, they're not straight 18-year-olds, right? They've usually come out of the military and they go back to school.
usually all students in Israel are after military service. They would be probably at the age of 22 and above. Sometimes you'll find a 26-year-old men or women that are only at their undergrad studies. And they usually study and work at the same time, sometimes build a family, and so on.
So they're more mature and able to do some of these miraculous things. Well, thanks for a great story, and I will check my mail for unmanned drones.
Thank you.
Thanks, Guy. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant J-Bar in Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
It is the prettiest time of year now, isn't it?
It's J-Bar time. Time to sit outside on the porch, get a margarita. I didn't tell you this. We just won best margaritas in Tucson at J-Bar. Mm. Sit outside, have a margarita, serve some great food. Be thankful you live here in Southern Arizona.
It is a wonderful time of year. What's special on the menu now?
Well, right now, all our food from the farmers are coming in. So peas and pea shoots and carrots and radishes and citrus. So all of those things are finding their way on the menu in preparations with trout and rabbit and beef and duck. Great fun foods of the region. Great flavors. Great time to be there.
Boy, I'm hungry and thirsty just hearing about it. What's the phone number?
615-6100.
And it's www.janos.com.
Rabbi, you always know how to find me.
And I love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in Southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about freedom in the Middle East and the implications for the for Israel, but also for really the whole region with all of the potential changes in government and potential changes in government and unrest and agitation for freedom and democracy. You talked about circles that reinforce each other, both bad and good. Let's go into that a little more. Let's amplify that.
Right. So there's two concepts that are basically the opposite of each other. One is a vicious circle in which many of these countries have found themselves for the past 50 years or so, ever since the British and the French, between them, divided up the Ottoman Empire, created countries with artificial boundaries, appointed ruling families, which had no local legitimacy or local standing.
Pretty much based on their loyalty to whatever the colonial power was.
Right. And so people have suffered to one degree or another under governments that they haven't chosen, governments which they don't feel represent their best interests, and governments which have, to one degree or another, fallen very far short of our ideals of good governance, which means the rule of law, independent judiciary, an even playing field, participatory democracy with a strong civil society and sort of a system of checks and balances. And all of that promotes, for example, good environmental stewardship, good assurances of reasonably equal rights for a widely diverse group of people. And those conditions, in turn, create a climate that's attractive to foreign direct investment. So foreigners invest more in the economy. There's greater prosperity. More jobs are created, less unemployment, higher levels of educational achievement, more prosperity, more democracy, et cetera, et cetera. That is a virtuous circle. When things go right, each thing reinforces the other and helps pull a country out of poverty and illiteracy and sort of illegitimacy, a failed state or a failing state, into this sort of virtuous circle. The vicious circle is where everything bad reinforces everything else, which is there's an illegitimate government, people are unhappy, there's high unemployment, high poverty, high illiteracy. Government fails to provide public services of the sort that people need and want. So people don't get much education. They don't get much on-the-job training. There's not a level playing field. There's no assurances to foreign investors that they're going to be able to get their money out or that they're going to be able to operate without bribing the right official because everybody's corrupt. So the country becomes less and less attractive to foreign direct investment and more isolated and impoverished and paranoid and whatever. So whatever happens in these countries, it seems to me that it's in the absolute interest of both the United States and of Israel to encourage any forces that help break the vicious circle and also at the same time encourage moving countries toward this virtuous circle where everybody both in the country and in the neighboring countries is going to be better off.
You know, I've always said evil is contagious, but so is good.
Right.
And maybe that's a more simplistic way of saying the same thing. Tom, thanks very much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie was divorcing her husband Moshe. After 2 months of waiting, case was finally being heard in court. The judge asked Sadie, "So, how old are you?" "I'm 40 years old, Your Honor." The judge replied, "Please, answer my questions honestly. You're under oath. How old are you?" "I'm 40 years old, Your Honor," answers Sadie again. "Well," says the judge, "you're not being truthful. It's written down here you were born in August 1945. That means you're over 65. "But, Your Honor," replies Sadie, "I'm not counting the last 20 years with my husband." "Why not?" asks the judge. "This you call living?" replies Sadie. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Emor, which includes the passages that celebrate all the festivals of the Jewish year. Last week's Torah portion of Kiddushim focused on the holiness of truly ethical conduct. In Emor, we move to the ways that rituals create holiness in our lives, in particular by setting aside times and seasons for sacredness, and then dedicating these to God. In a conservative or Orthodox congregation, Emor is one of the most frequently read Torah portions of all, because it's chanted both when it falls in the normal reading cycle and again on each of the festivals in turn. That is, we would read Emor this week, but also on each of the various festivals, from Sukkot in the fall to Pesach in the spring, just last week. Surprisingly, repetition is considered a sign of additional sacredness. In most areas of our lives, those things that happen rarely are considered to be more important. Graduation days, wedding days, even vacations are exceptional for their rarity. But paradoxically, in Judaism, those rituals which are observed more frequently are considered superior in holiness to those which occur less frequently. The more you do something or read something ritually, the holier it becomes. The things we do the most are considered to be the most important, or they should be anyway. The implied lesson is that our actions should reflect our values. We ought to spend our time doing what matters most. By doing this, we create sacredness. Which means that the process of remembering and celebrating the festivals, and particularly the most frequent festival of all, the Shabbat, is especially important. For when we connect to these emblems of our religious tradition, when we embrace the rituals and special celebrations, we come to own that which can be holy in our own lives. And we learn that we can do it daily, or at least weekly, through finding ways to regularly observe the Sabbath, also mentioned in Emor. On this week of this Torah portion, may we each find a way to embrace holiness in a way that it becomes a habit. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll talk with Ishmael Chaldi, the first Bedouin to serve in Israel's Foreign Service, who tells a remarkable story of his own experience and will let us know just what Bedouins think of Israel, all in just a few moments on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
For the second time in the last couple of months, Egypt has shut off its gas supply to Israel following an explosion on the pipeline in Sinai. The explosion last week rocked the area and caused 65-foot-high flames. While Egyptian officials would not speculate on the cause of the blast, a security source said that an unidentified armed gang attacked the pipeline. Egypt supplies Israel with about 40% of the natural gas the country needs to produce electricity. The supply of gas from Egypt was shut down for a month and has not returned to full levels since terrorists in the Sinai tried to blow up the pipeline back in February during the uprising against then-Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, since deposed. On March 27th, terrorists failed in a second attempt to bomb the pipeline after explosives didn't detonate. But this time they got it. Israeli officials, in response, called for their own country to find ways to reduce their dependency on other countries for gas and urged the government to quickly develop the newly found huge gas fields off the coast of Israel. The Israel Electric Company said it has enough gas in the pipeline for a few days and will then switch to alternative fuels like coal and diesel to produce their electricity. The supply of gas to Jordan was also interrupted. The pipeline between Egypt and Israel opened back in 2008. Selling gas to Israel was unpopular on the Egyptian street from the time the pipeline opened. Egyptian authorities have extended Mubarak's detention to question him regarding the gas deal with Israel, in which Egypt somehow lost more than $700 million. Candidates to replace Mubarak have said they plan to renegotiate the contract with Israel. An Argentinian journalist reveals in a new book that supposedly Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin agreed to help Argentina during the 1982 Falklands War as revenge for Britain's crackdown on his own underground military group Irgun during the British Mandate period in Palestine. Operation Israel, the rearming of Argentina during the dictatorship by Hernan Dobry, explains how Israel secretly supplied arms and equipment to Argentina via Peru. According to the book, Begin authorized the deal by saying, "Is this going to be used to kill the English? Kadima," which means go ahead. Dov from up there is going to be happy with the decision. Dov Gruner was a close friend of Begin who was captured by the British and hanged by them in April of 1947. "Obviously, it must all be done perfectly," added Begin. The testimony to this conversation was provided by Israel Lotterstein, then a salesman for ISREX, an Israeli defense company in Argentina. "What Israel did was all within legal channels," Dobry said. "But support to Argentina during the Falklands War was shown only by a few countries in the world, like Libya and Peru. Apparently, the most risky deal concerned supplying 23 French-built Mirage 3CS fighter aircraft to Argentina. They were camouflaged with the Peruvian flag. Israel also allegedly armed Argentina's military dictatorship with air-to-air missiles, fuel tanks for fighter bombers, gas masks, missile radar alert systems, and the warm Dubonim jackets famous in the IDF. If the U.S. hadn't turned a blind eye, it would have been impossible for Israel to send such a large amount of weapons," Dobry claims. "Many components were American. There is a U.S. law that prohibits the sale of any military component to third parties without authorization by the White House." Very interesting, even if old information. Britain, of course, retook the Falkland Islands, called the Islas Malvinas in Argentina, in June of 1982, 2.5 months after Argentina tried to recover the islands, or capture them, depending on how you look at it. More than 250 British servicemen and 650 Argentines were killed in the Falklands War. More recently, just last week, an Israeli was killed and at least four wounded during a visit to Joseph's tomb near the West Bank city of Nablus. The men were part of a group of 15 Bratslav Hasidim who arrived in three cars to pray at the site, holy to Jews, and located in West Bank territory under full Palestinian control. The worshippers did not coordinate their visit with the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces. Apparently, a Palestinian security guard fired on one of the cars as it was leaving the site, saying the men's activities looked suspicious. They were, after all, praying. Worshippers in the other cars said the Palestinian police officers shouted, "Allahu Akbar," the Arabic "God is great," as he shot at the vehicles leaving the site. A joint IDF-Palestinian investigation is looking into it. The dead man was identified as Ben Yosef Livnat, 25 years old, a father of four from Jerusalem. He's the nephew of Israeli Science and Culture Minister Limor Livnat, a leader of the ruling Likud party. Rioting occurred in Nablus following the incident, and the tomb was reportedly set on fire by Palestinian youths. It was recently renovated after being badly damaged and desecrated by Palestinians during the Second Palestinian Intifada. Minister Livnat said in a statement that her nephew had wanted to pray at the tomb in honor of Pesach and said he was killed in cold blood in an abominable way. The Israeli army coordinates monthly prayer visits to the tomb, believed to be the burial site of the biblical patriarch Joseph and his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Members of the Bratslav sect frequently visit the tomb to pray, and they often don't coordinate their visits with the IDF. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Ishmael Chaldi. He's a policy advisor to Israel's foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman. He is Israel's first Bedouin diplomat, born and raised in a Bedouin village in the north of Israel. He served in the IDF, the defense ministry, and the Israeli police, before being chosen to join the foreign ministry in 2004. During the disengagement from Gaza, Ishmael Chaldi served as Israel's official spokesperson to the Arab media. He then joined the North American division. He has spoken all around the world, and he has a book called A Shepherd's Journey about his own experience moving from the Bedouin society, the nomadic society of the Bedouin, into what can hardly, well, I guess, you know, in the foreign ministry, you're kind of nomadic too, but in a different way, moving from post to post, but very sophisticated part of society. Tell us a little bit about representing Israel to the Arab world. That must be a challenge.
Being a diplomat is not an easy life. You know, facing the challenges that Israel is facing today all over the world, and both as a Jewish state, but of course because of the political situation in the region, conflict with the Palestinians, issues with Iran and others, and someone like myself who's coming from, you know, not Jewish, Muslim, share more or less the same culture with Israel's enemies, let me say, that makes more challenges for me. So when I went to San Francisco, for instance, so you are facing, I was facing, you know, Muslim communities who are looking at you as, you know, in a different eye, different views. Part of the Jewish communities also. And that's a challenge. You know, you are being sometimes slapped from here and from here.
Right.
And there's no other way. This is the reality, and those are the facts. And you have to stand up.
You know, when I lived in Israel, the stereotype was the Bedouins were great trackers. You know, they were the scouts for the army, and they could find anybody and track anything. That didn't translate necessarily to real respect for their intellectual ability, for the culture. Do you experience some resistance, some bias? You mentioned Jewish communities outside of Israel. Did you feel any of that within Israel?
No, you know, there's a great respect for us, who we are, both the culture and the heritage that we represent, the values that we represent.
This has been a very interesting time in the Middle East. You know, there's a curse. May you live in interesting times. Everything seems to be up in the air right now. You know, Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, Iran,
Libya.
Of course, the whole region is in tumult to some degree or another. We always think it is from here, but really they've had very stable, oppressive leadership for a very long time. How is Israel responding? What kind of challenges does that create for you as a diplomat?
Well, for Israel, every diplomat, every Israeli representative, it's challenging. Nobody, by the way, expected that to happen.
Right.
Before.
You know, anybody who says they did, they're lying.
Exactly, overnight.
Right.
So it creates, you know, instability.
You know, and I left out Bahrain, and you know,
in Yemen right now, Qatar, everything right. is you know, instability doesn't make us happy. look what's happening in Lebanon right now. It's like a fogakta, as they say in Yiddish, a mess.
All forgot.
And in Egypt, our neighbor, you know, it might reflect on the relations between us and Egypt. Who knows who will be the leader in Egypt? We have a peace treaty with them. Same thing with Jordan. But it's challenging. You know, it's not easy. We are always still, you know, with the hand open and pointed for peace, for dialogue. No matter, you know, what will happen in the region.
When you go back home, and you go back to your home, I guess village is correct, how different does it seem to you now, and how are you perceived?
Okay, a role model. Everybody wants to do the same. Sometimes jealousy even, because people want to be, you know, all over. They want to travel, they want to see the world, they want to represent the country. It's a status, after all, for someone.
Big status, really.
For a society which is, grew up as shepherds.
Are your relatives still shepherds?
You know, but not like in the past. Not like in the past. And even in the past, we used to move. No, today we are, you know,
Cemetery in towns.
Exactly. Right. But still, you know, we are raising animals and but going more to school, going to more to work outside, not depending on our farms as the
principal source of income.
Exactly.
Right. You know, in a way, you represent, if any one individual can represent the kinds of changes that are going on, as you say, in the whole world, from it used to be a very spread world. Now everything happens so fast, everybody's so connected. But still, your journey is unique. Are there other Bedouin coming up, say, in the foreign ministry? You were the first. Do you know of others that are now being accepted in the Israeli foreign ministry?
Yes, there's another one who came from the military. You know, the government have a policy to integrate much as more Bedouins to government positions and responsibilities. I want to see more. You know, we are going more to school. The young generation is going to college more and going to university and becoming more open-minded, not staying only in the village. I want to see more Bedouin women, you know, finishing college and joining the Foreign Service or, you know, any other government responsibility. Because we are able. We have the right also to do it. You know, keeping the tradition, it's not easy. But we try to combine the best in both worlds. You know, best on our best values and from our culture, and also the best on the modern world that we live in.
You know, we were talking earlier, and you mentioned, you know, one of your closest friends is a Chabadnik, and that you like Chabad. Can you talk about that a little bit?
No, and the first time I came to this country was right after high school, and I came to Brooklyn because to New York City before going to Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Even a friend from the kibbutz told me his brother is working there. And he gave me even the number. And I decided, freaked out, and they told me, look, America is the land of milk and honey, golden life. And I decided to make it. To make it short, I landed early in the morning at JFK and dialed the number that I had, but I lost my friend. He wasn't there. So I said, I'm not going to give up. I started to cry. My first time out of the village, out of the country, and New York City. I cried for about 20 minutes. And after 20 minutes, I'm seeing a Chabadnik. He turned to be Chabadnik later, but ultra-Orthodox. I said, I know those people from Israel. This is the Mashiach, and he will help me. I'm alone here. And I ran all the way to him, crying. And that's where my first meeting with Chabad started. He helped me, calmed me down. He sent me to Brooklyn Borough Park, 13th Avenue. And, you know, we have so many values that we share together. You know, family values, respect for others.
Community.
Exactly. Very close. Very, very close. My parents, when they came to visit me in San Francisco, the best time they had is when we went to Shabbat with Chabad. So, and by the way, this is why I decided to write the autobiography, Shepherd's Journey. That tells the entire story of Israel, of course, through my views, my community, and the relations between
It's a great story, and I think a wonderful and a fascinating tale in general. I want to thank Ishmael Chaldi for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called A Shepherd's Journey, and it's available online.
On my website and Amazon.
And your website is?
IshmaelChaldi.com.
So it's IshmaelChaldi.com. And, you know, if you look up Israel's first Bedouin diplomat, you'll find him, no problem at all. Ishmael, thank you so much, and continued luck, Matzlacha.
Thank you very much. Bye.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation invites you to experience Enduring Eyes, Remembering the Holocaust to Protect Our Future. Enduring Eyes is an exhibit of first-hand descriptions and photographs that explores the history of the Holocaust, the atrocities leading up to and during the Holocaust, and emphasizes the importance of protecting our civil rights, a priority the FBI upholds. Enduring Eyes, now showing and free to the public at the Jewish Community Center, 3800 East River Road.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, most of the time I'm talking about the great pizza we serve at Mama's, but not today. Nope. Today I want to tell you about our calzones. A calzone is kind of like a stuffed pizza. It's made of dough wrapped around whatever ingredients you want, like pepperoni, mushrooms, or even artichoke hearts. There's lots of cheese inside, and it's served with a cup of marinara sauce. Our calzones are huge. We had a guy order two of them over the phone, and when he picked them up, he couldn't believe it. There were only two people eating, and two large calzones feed 6 to 8 people easy. You know, it wouldn't hurt you to try a calzone next time you're in. Then, if they get real popular, we might have to change our name to Mama's Calzones. Nah. Mama's Pizza, 4500 East Speedway in the Midway Business Park, on the east side of 22nd and Kolb and back at the Fry Shopping Center, on the north side at the southwest corner of Oracle and McGee, and on newest at Broadway and Houghton. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Lucas Richman, conductor of two symphony orchestras, not one but two, and the composer of a variety of outstanding Jewish classical music. Our playout this morning comes from the prayer for the counting of the Omer, the daily process of enumerating the 50 days between Passover, our holiday of freedom, and Shavuot, the holiday of covenant. It's the prayer Sheyabona Beis Hamikdash, may God rebuild the temple speedily in our day, from the great cantor Ben Sion Miller. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Shayyabon.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.